All right, and welcome everyone. It's Sunday afternoon. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Revolution Radio's Cancel the Cabal. I have a very, very special guest. First, I'll give a little bit of a background. He's a political activist. He lives over in Ireland right now. His website is www.ddi.eu.com. And what DDI stands for is Direct Democracy Ireland. I'm going to give a little quote here from him first before I introduce him. He says, "I am passionate about our individual sovereignty, our unalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness without government interference. This experience of life, liberty, and happiness, or true spiritual freedom, can be experienced through meditation. This experience of freedom in meditation called
Samadhi.
Samadhi leads to true spiritual liberation." Sorry about that. Didn't know what that word was. "The experience of what nature meant sovereignty to be. The founding fathers of the United States were also deists tried funding a new nation on its principle by declaring that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." The Declaration of Independence by Thomas Jefferson in 1776. My special guest today is political activist Jan van de Ven. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. I guess one of the first questions anyone might ask is, what is Direct Democracy Ireland?
Direct Democracy Ireland came about through myself and another guy named Raymond Whitehead, who lived in Switzerland, and which both of us have. I've lived there, he's lived there. And in Switzerland, we discovered a method of representative democracy where the people have the power to initiate referendum, very much like in California. But in California, you can initiate referendum, but let's say you're trying to have GMO labeling on products, your opposition can spend as much money as they can to try to outspend you and win, and therefore not have the referendum succeed. But in Switzerland, they regulate it more, and they don't let one side outspend the other side, and they have a really intelligent debate about it, and then the people make up their mind. So both of us lived in Switzerland and learned about this, and we eventually, Raymond is Irish, I'm Dutch, and I moved to Ireland, he came back, and I've been saying that this is a great system of government, and we need that here in Ireland so that, the people are sovereign, and the people have with that power, they would have the right to overrule the government on laws or legislation that they didn't agree with. And as I was campaigning for that, he then discovered me, and we sat down and had a cup of tea and talked about it. And eventually the Direct Democracy Ireland was founded out of that meeting. And along the way, we also discovered that this power was actually in the first Irish Free State Constitution, when they declared, when they had their revolution with the United Kingdom and kind of got their not complete independence. At that point, they were an autonomous state. This power was also enshrined in their constitution, but it was taken out when Eamon de Valera, who was half American, half Irish / Cuban, came here and, was very involved in politics. Decided to use that because he didn't want to sign an oath of allegiance, because in those days people had to sign an oath of allegiance to King George, in order to be in the government because it was an autonomous state and he didn't want to do it. So he was the first person to exercise that power to initiate referendum. And when he did that, and he brought the signatures to the government, they refused to receive the signatures. And then they proceeded to pull the articles out of the Constitution, so that power was never exercised. So in a sense, you know, our campaign is making the people of Ireland aware that they had that power in the first Irish Free State Constitution, what the features of the power are, what it means to have that power, that it makes your sovereignty stronger and it puts you in charge of your government, and that you can overrule the government when they pass a law that makes you unhappy. And in addition to the fact that we're campaigning to put it back. So that's basically what Direct Democracy Ireland is.
Yeah, very good. Many of the people, well, just millions and millions of people just don't understand what their own personal power is. You want to explain what sovereignty is to maybe the few listeners out here that don't know what it is?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting because, I have learned about it over the years, and when I first kind of got involved in it, and my understanding of it is still evolving. But essentially, the way I understand it is that, or the way that I see it right now is that, we used to be, most of the countries in the world had some type of a sovereign ruler, a king, a queen, just like the United States used to be, run by the King of England. And so, what happened was, is when we had our revolutions, we still had the idea of being a sovereign, because when you're the sovereign, you own all the resources in the land, and you basically kill anybody that disagrees with you. And you just, and you create a police force or occupy the land with an army, and you basically, to control all the people you didn't kill. You basically, create a flag, a song, and put a fence around it and call out a country. And so most countries were ruled by sovereigns. And when we had our revolutions, we became the sovereign. That meant that the people became the sovereign. So in the same way that a sovereign rules a country, the sovereign wasn't involved in every single decision of the state. He had people running his state, running his affairs for him, but he always had the power to overrule them when he thought that maybe the people were getting too disgruntled by what they were doing, or he didn't think they were raising enough taxes, or they did something that was just completely wrong. He would come in and step in and say, no, throw that out, I don't want to do that. So in the same way that that's true for a king or a queen, that now became true for us. So what we did was we created a constitution, and we had, and we created a representative government to handle the business of the state, because we now, all the people together, became the sovereign citizens of the state. All together, we own everything. So what we do is, that's why we have an election, because the representatives come to us for our sovereign power and our right to represent us. And we cede that power to them, and then they run the affairs of the state. So what people need to realize that a democracy, one definition of a democracy is that you vote once every 4 years. In Switzerland, their definition of a democracy is that that not only do you vote for your politicians, but you have a right to step in at any time when the politicians, for example, when their government passes a law, they have 90 days to raise 50,000 signatures to throw it out. And if they raise the 50,000 signatures, they'll have a referendum. And if people disagree, that law gets thrown out. And they have, if they want to change the constitution, all they have to do is gather 100,000 signatures and then have a referendum on anything in the constitution. So that way the people are in charge, which they should be anyway, because the country belongs to the people. But somehow we bought into this idea that, we vote once every 4 years. And then these people represent us, and then they decide over our lives, when actually we're the ones who should decide over our representatives and whether they're doing it right or not. Now, we do have the power of referendum, let's say in California, where the people abolished property tax, and that was great for the people of California. But the problem is that the government itself never wanted to balance the budgets. Just like anywhere in the world, governments are constantly borrowing money because they're constantly pushing the problem into the future. So you could even use direct democracy, like people have in Switzerland, to more regulate the government and tell them what they can do and what they can't do. In the same way that you would regulate your own finances to be fiscally responsible, so you don't create a lot of debt for yourself and complicate your life.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It really does. it gives more power back to the people. I know over here in America, I think practically since day one of that signing of the Declaration of Independence, they've been slowly eroding and taking away the people's sovereignty.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, in a sense, it's always like when the revolution is just over, you know, and everybody's had their, you know, their legs blown off, everybody's lost their loved ones, you know, people have been homeless and starved to death and went through great pain. The first few days after the revolution, everybody's so stoked that they're free finally from this tyrannical force that was destroying their lives. I mean, most people who fight revolutions, they just finally go like, you know what? I can't take this tyranny on anymore. I don't want to go through another day of tyranny. I would rather fight these, you know, this ruler and resist the bully than to live another day in tyranny. So that's what people do. They finally say, life has gotten so bad. I don't care anymore. I'm just going to, you know, grab a gun, anything I can and resist to fight back. And eventually what happens is, more and more people agree, and then you eventually overthrow the ruler. So in a sense, you know, right after the revolution, everybody's very, you know, sincere. But as time goes on and politicians get the experience of power more and more, and especially in the way our governments are run, because, you know, when you have a lot of power, you know, just like kind of on the dollar bill, you see this pyramid with this eye at the apex. In a sense, when you have a government with very few people at the top that are in control, that have a lot of power, then if you are a very rich person, or you're a very powerful corporate interest, then you have very, very few people to lobby. And so in the same way, like, for example, like you have Europe now is unified with a president and a defense minister. And you have, you've got the leader of Russia, you've got the leader of India, you've got the leader of China, and the leader of the United States. Those five leaders represent half the people of the world. So the more and more that you can concentrate more and more, power into the hands of fewer and fewer people, then it's easy to, if you're a very powerful, wealthy force, then it's easy to lobby them and to sort of tip the scale in your favor, almost like a pinball machine. If you always want to win, then you have to be able to tilt the pinball machine in a way that you don't set off the alarm. So people, you know, if you look into a lot of plutocrats of the world, they are very well connected politically, and they're constantly tipping the economic table in their favor, to the adverse effect, for the many. So it's always the favor of the few to the adverse of the many. And the many have to realize that we're actually very strong. And if we come together, because if we will ourselves the power to have a greater democracy and have more sovereign power, if we will that for ourselves and we elect politicians who stand for that, who want to manifest or implement that, then through natural, you know, politicking, we can manifest that for ourselves and we can turn the tables. For example, like with direct democracy, let's say you're an environmentalist. You want to protect the environment. Maybe there's a factory up the river, and you drink all this nice drinking water that's, you know, in your wells and coming out of the river, and you purify it. But somehow there's a lot of toxicity getting into the water, and due to the factory, through direct democracy, you could actually maybe on a local level, if you had that power locally, maybe in your county, you could then have a vote, and you might be able to regulate that factory, that business. So in a sense, the people and the politicians need to have power sharing in an equitable manner. And the more that you have direct democracy, the more clear or transparent it becomes. The more that the power is concentrated in the hands of very, very few people, then a lot of deals are made in behind closed doors, and it's very opaque.
Certainly. There's a man in a organization over here in America. The name escapes me now, but his name is Paul Cienfuego. He's been doing a lot of the same things, I think, very, very similar to democracy now, or direct
democracy in Ireland. Yeah.
Direct democracy. They are using on the local level, the local legislation, like, they've had like 180 victories, all over the country in America. Mm-hmm. Many victories up in Oregon where he's stationed, and some in Pennsylvania, and some all scattered all over the country. But they get a referendum like you're talking about on the local level, and they pass a local law. They've stopped fracking in many areas. Mm-hmm. They've stopped mega corporations from coming in and taking the land through where they can annex your land.
I don't know, but I get the point. Yeah.
Yeah. The name escapes me now, but somebody might pop it in the chat room there. But they've had like 180 plus victories over the last decade or so now. I think they started in like 2001 or 2002. And, excuse me. And it's been a bipartisan movement, both, liberal and, conservative are fighting their cases on a local level and beating a lot of the big boys.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what the people need to realize is that together we're strong, and fragmented. You know, if we constantly bicker and arguments amongst ourselves, then we're weak. And you know, it's the old divide and conquer thing. So for example, I remember a few years back, it's quite a long time ago, where all these in New Zealand, you know, they tried to get the government to you know to ban nuclear power. But the government refused to do that because they were being lobbied by some very powerful interests, you know. So basically what happened is on every single county level and every village level, they had a vote where they would say no nuclear material can come through our streets, through our village. And they slowly banned it. And what you had is after more and more and more villages, you could see it on a map. You know, let's say you had a green dot, you know, where they banned it. And pretty soon you could see like whole parts of the country. So to the point where they so many people banned it on a local level that it actually did it nationally. Similar idea there.
Yeah. That's very interesting to explore, even on a state level.
I learned about that because I used to go to these, Western Shoshone Nation. When I was living out in California, I used to go to the nuclear protest because their land there, they've had over 1,000 nuclear bombs tested on their land. And, you know, the Indians are always, they love nature, and to have people do that to their land, it's like it flipped them out, you know, and they keep going like, well, we have this treaty that, you know, we signed with the government in 1831 or whatever it was. And, you know, they said that, you know, this is our land, you know, cause, you know, we used to live in this beautiful plush forest, but we kept getting moved out more and more into the desert. So they did all this testing there. And so once a year, the Indians, they just return to their land and they walk across the gate and they just get arrested. And that's what they do. And it was there that I learned about, you know, that thing in New Zealand. That's interesting.
Yeah. Eminent domain. That was the word I was trying to find.
Mm-hmm.
But, it escaped my mind there for a few seconds. What kind of victories has, Direct Democracy Ireland had?
Well, I mean, you know, we're, you know, actually we formed the party about a year and a half ago.
Oh, okay.
It took a few years for us to get to the point where we could create a party, because none of us had ever done anything like this before. You know, we're just like regular people just doing our own thing. And at some point, you know, just saying, hey, this is a good idea. And then eventually people said, oh yeah, it's a great idea. What can we do about it? And then we said, well, let's create a party. And it was like, has anybody ever done that before?
Sure.
No. You know, so how do you do that? You know, so we've been sort of like, you know, just learning along the way. And, you know,
educating the people, right?
Huh?
Education is a big thing.
Yeah. We the people, you know, so it was kind of hilarious because we ran our first kind of, you could say our first, you know, I guess you would call it a, you know, you could say a senator, kind of an American equivalent of a senator, you know, like about a year ago. And, we came out of nowhere and we beat, a lot of people, including some of the politicians of the main government party that are in government.
Sure.
So all of a sudden we became, all of a sudden everybody noticed us. You know, first of all, they never gave us any media attention, and like they would, everybody else was on media and television and interviews and radio, and us, they were like, get out of here. What do you want? You know,
right.
But we did so well that they couldn't believe it. You know, we did everything to prevent you from getting anything, and you beat all these people. So that's how we first came to the media attention. And then, the guy, Ben Gilroy, who came to media attention, was also, he was also sort of, challenging a lot of foreclosures and helping people stay in their homes and things like that, using different kinds of tactics, especially the Constitution, questioning what they were doing and say, hey, this is unconstitutional. But, the sheriff always goes like, well, I'm sorry, I'm supposed to do this. But he says, well, look here, in this part of the Constitution, you can't do that. And then, it created a big deal, and one of his videos went viral, so
yes.
He became famous through that. So you probably saw it.
Yes, I have. I've tried to get Ben on a couple of times, but he's been so busy. I had him scheduled one night, and he got a call, and there was a foreclosure and a eviction, and he went and stopped it. So I was out of a guest for the night, but luckily somebody else filled in. But he's a very busy guy.
And, yeah. So he kind of like blew them away, and of course everybody got worried. Here's this guy that came out of nowhere with a message, and he did really well. So everybody immediately, had him on all the shows, and they were all like, "Who are you? What's your name? Where are you coming from? What do you believe? What's this all about?" And then once they figured it out, then they tried to figure out how they could character assassinate him. So then the whole thing became, like the classic cut the head off the snake. So they tried to pin a bunch of Freeman stuff on him and, make him look like what they call a loon, and all this kind of stuff. And the media was really into it, and they were really pushing it and hidden cameras and anything they could do to make it, to make it kind
Try
of
to
edgy.
Trip him up.
And
yeah.
Like the guy was really like, you can't trust the guy.
Sure.
And of course, in the end, he proved through a bunch of court cases. He proved how, because they took him, they eventually figured out how to arrest him. They took him to court. He, can I say bad words here?
You probably shouldn't, no.
Probably not, okay. But anyway, so he proved that the government, witnesses were all lying, like the lawyers that were trying to nail him working with the government were all bank lawyers, from the Anglo-Irish Bank, that is the reason why we have a big debt. This whole thing that he unraveled, So anyway, they try to character assassinate him, and eventually the everything in the media and all of the internet trolls, everybody was just harping on it. So eventually he stepped aside and I became the leader because nobody has anything on me yet.
There you go.
So that whole thing went away, right?
Certainly is. Yeah. I guess it's not like he can't take the pressure or anything. It's just maybe taking the pressure off of him and maybe trying to take some focus off of the movement, so to speak.
Yeah. He was all tied up in all this lawsuits, and he's what they call a lay litigant. And two of the guys who ran for our party, because we just had a European election where myself and three other guys ran. One is Ben, another guy named Tom Darcy. We were both, the country's most famous lay litigants. They've won Supreme Court cases against banks and things like that, and showing the corruption. And basically, what Tom has brought to, into the limelight is that way back in 2006, 2007, the government, the banks went into the government and said, hey, we need to get a banking license, but we're insolvent. And according to the law, you can't get a banking license when you're insolvent.
Correct.
So the government went, huh?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, so the government went like, well, if we let the world know that our banks are insolvent and we can't give you a banking license, then what's going to happen to the market? It's going to affect the market, So what they did was they kind of, the highest levels of government, the central bank, the European Central Bank, and all the banks went into collusion and decided to allow the banking system to operate without a license, which is illegal. And of course, when the you know what hit the fan,
they asked for bailouts.
A big bailout had to happen when they could have dealt with it a long time ago and possibly, you know, wound these things down and done it a better way. But then the people of Ireland were saddled with this huge debt. And of course, anybody that wants to investigate that or look into that, it's like you can't get anything in media. And so part of the reason we ran some of the candidates, were to kind of get those stories out, because when you're running the media, especially for the European Parliament, then you have a platform in order to share the message and to get that information to the public.
Oh, yes, absolutely. They do the same things over here. They ignore you, and then they attack you, and then you win. As the little phrase goes, I think it might have been.
People say Gandhi said it, but I don't know. Yeah. People argue that too. Then maybe not. Maybe he did. I don't know.
Sure. I mean, it doesn't really matter. The saying's out there, and it's hopefully it holds true. They've been attacking us for, I don't know, quite a long time now. We're a little. Terrorists, we're little dissenters, we're un-American. It's just a silly little ad hominem attack is all it is. And, people that don't really know how to combat it. And, that's hopefully one of my, things I started this internet radio was to help people recognize the attacks and, how to get around their, little deceptions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the whole thing is this, it's sort of like, you know, they have a gravy train, and they've had it for quite a long time. So if you're beginning to challenge the gravy train, then, they're going to try every trick in the book in order to minimize you or to somehow, mess you up or slow you down so that they can continue doing what they're doing. And the thing about it is they can do it because they can. That's the way it is. You know, that's what power is all about. They can do it because they can. And if you want to challenge them, then you have to outsmart them, outcampaign them, outtalk them, outthink them, whatever. So that's the opportunity that's available to us right now. Now, I don't know if somebody in my generation is going to do that, or whether somebody, you know, who's being born right now, you know, who's growing up with the internet, who's, you know, switching on all these channels and getting dialed in and learning all this stuff at a young age, and will have the power in itself, the guts and the intelligence and the know-how to somehow maybe waken everybody up. And because the thing about it is that if we waken up to our sovereignty and how powerful we really are, it's like pulling the shackles off of us, you know, because we can create the world that we want. Either we create it and overrule the politicians, you know, who are basically saying one thing, do another. They'll tell you anything that you want to hear. And once they get into office or into power, then they're off, doing the bidding of the people who donated to their campaigns, you know. So in a sense, you know, sovereignty is for sale. So it's up to us. The more that we can educate ourselves, the more we can learn, the more we, you know, the thing that really blows my mind is that how is it possible that if, you know, but maybe not everybody, you know, digs into the internet as to the extent that we might research things and try to find out what's going on and, you know, and try to understand possibly different ways of thinking and different ways of looking at things. Maybe a lot of people still get all their information from television and the boob tube, or they get their program, you know, they sit down for their programming, you know?
Yes. Yes. There is a reason why they call it a program.
Yeah. So they're all being programmed, you know, so, and they're believing it, you know, that's their belief system, you know, so until they, you know, start looking elsewhere and educating themselves, because they're not going to learn that much about sovereignty, you know, in school. You're going to learn that you have a democracy, and that you're going to learn about George Washington, and you're going to learn about the Declaration of Independence, and, you know, what a great country America is.
Yeah.
And that democracy is that you vote once every 4 years. and that's about it. You know, and you know, that's about it. You know,
sure.
That, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's also another quote out there that's been attributed to Joseph Stalin, but, I don't know if it's true or not, but, I think they, claim that he said also, if you want to enslave a nation, you give them a vote and tell them they're free.
Mm-hmm. I like your Goebbels one.
I'm sorry?
I like your Goebbels quote.
Yeah. Yeah. The Goebbels. Everybody does. Yes. I can't even see it myself, but,
yeah. It was if you tell a lie long enough, eventually everybody's going to believe it.
Yes. Yes. That's what it is. And he was a propaganda, mm-hmm. master back in the '30es and forties. He captured a nation with, rhetoric and, deceptions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. It's because of him that, Hitler became as powerful as he became.
Well, it was, I think a lot of people, me especially, a lot of people don't even know that the Obama campaign in 2008 was actually a ad campaign. And it, over here in America, they give awards every single year for the best marketing campaign. And the Obama campaign won it for the year 2008. So
I know.
How can a advertising acclamation really be given to a presidential candidate? And that, that's really got to speak volume to somebody that's kind of on the fence, maybe on whether they're, going to believe the false left right paradigm or whether they're going to, stay with the blue pill, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, he also won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah. Yes, he did. Nobel Peace Prize winning president, and he starts 5 new wars.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you can go there, but it's just crazy. It's crazy. You know, we're bringing democracy to everyone. You know, I mean, just the amount of loss of life and the destruction of their countries is just unbelievable.
Well,
it's just
a matter of how much people are going to take. People all over the world are really on the edge, and some countries, I think, like, somewhere in South America, some of them countries down there, they are on the verge of a revolution. And some of the Eastern Bloc countries in Europe are on the verge of a revolution also. Just wonder how much it's going to take.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, you can say that's the beauty of a democracy, because in a democracy, at least, you, let's say in the United States, it's once every 4 years, and in Ireland, it's once every 5 years. It's like you have a little mini revolution. And you could almost say that, like the established parties are like these really big armies, and they have a huge pot of money, you know, and they can have, you know, lots of posters and TV ads and radio ads and, you know, in every which way they can reach you with their message, which is basically say one thing to another, but everybody believes it and tries it again. It's like going back to the unfaithful lover. And every time you believe them and every time you get disappointed, and then you have like the guerrilla forces, which are the small parties, the independent thinkers who are challenging, you know, what they stand for and, you know, don't believe them. You need to be sovereign. You need to be strong. You need to work for getting your sovereign power back. Then you can overrule the government and all this kind of stuff. And you're saying, here, we want to give you more sovereignty. We want to work with you to make you more free, you know, so that you can have a say in the outcome instead of having your outcome decided by a bunch of people with cigars sitting in a back room somewhere around a conference table, you know, as they split up all the riches of your country. You know, so in a sense, you know, that's why I like that Declaration of Independence, because it says, you know, that it's our right to create a new, you know, if the government doesn't suit us, then it's our right to create a new one that reflects our values, you know, and that is the beauty of democracy. So even if people say like, well, you know, what kind of a democracy do we have? But on some level, it's we still have the ability to somehow step in and try to change it.
Yes, yes, we do.
Without having to kill each other.
You know? Yes, yes, we can do this peacefully.
Yeah.
I, I say this a lot, and I don't even know if it resonates with people, but I think they are pushing hard, trying for a physical conflict. It seems over here in America, anyways, they are they're pushing hard with the police state. Are they doing that over there in Ireland too?
No, not really. Not well. You know, see, the thing about the United States, you have, you know, like Eisenhower said way back when, he warned us about the military-industrial complex. So what you have is, you have this, you know, you need, the United States needs a war in order for the economy to work, because you have so much invested in the infrastructure for war, you know, even on the, on the, on the security state level and on the military level. So, like, for example, if you look at Clinton, the only guy who ever balanced the budget and got a surplus, what did he do? He downsized the military. And that was the key, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And, on a little bit of a different note, my 73-year-old, stepdad has said quite a few times over the years, because I, get into arguments with him about these wars over there. He said when he was in 10th grade economics or current events or something, you know, government or whatever it was, that he was told by his instructor that the U.S. needed a war every 20 years to be able to sustain its economy. And I don't know. It's I don't think a nation should. It is.
I don't think about that. I mean, to think about, like, for example, like in the olden days, you know, you had, you would have, like, let's say stories out of the Bible, and you'd have somebody sacrificing a sheep or a cow or something to God or whatever, you know. And so in order to have an economy, you know, you, how many, what do we have to sacrifice on the altar? Okay, we'll sacrifice a few hundred thousand lives, and we can have a good economy. You know, to me, that's a little bit morbid, you know, and, you know, I'm one of the reasons I've got involved in politics, especially with the sovereign, you know, the sovereignty movement, like direct democracy, which is trying to make people more sovereign, is to speak truth to power. Because if you look at the foundation of let's say the United States, where it says, you know, we have these unalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that's a power that's given to us by the spirit of nature or the creator or whatever, then all people have those rights. So if you found a country on those rights and all people have those rights, then you need to find a way to live or a way to be or a way to have economic progress in a way that's maybe all more inclusive instead of one that's imperialist, you know?
Yes, yes, most certainly I do. The fact is, well, the thing I want to know is how much, you know, how many people need to die before people wake up and realize that war isn't the answer.
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, imagine this. Imagine, like, for example, I always have this image, you know, like, for example, imagine, like, you know, are you married?
No.
Okay, so you have friends that are married.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes.
They have small children and everything.
Oh, yes.
Now imagine them living in an apartment complex, and a cruise missile hits that apartment complex, right? And there's just rubble everywhere and fire everywhere. And there's a small baby laying in the middle of the rubble, and his mother's legs are blown off and bleeding to death. I mean, when I think about something like that, you know, I think about the loss of life. I think that every single life that is lost, that person had a brother, a sister, a mother, a father, a grandfather, children, every single one of these people. So when we think that we're just blowing people away, you know, we have to realize that what we're doing is we're actually, you know, destroying not only the life of that person, but the entire fabric of their family, you know. So I before I would pick up a gun and really start blowing people away, I have to think about all that before I do that. And if I'm going to pick up a gun, I better have a really, really freaking good reason to do it.
Oh, yes, yes. There was also somebody that quoted, I'd like to get these quotes in my head, and I mean, that I have in my head and write them down so I can get them right. But there was somebody, I think, back in the Second World War. A lot of us know that the media more or less stopped the Vietnam War, but I think some famous journalists said that a lot of the media had to be controlled in the Second World War, because if the truth got back to the American public and the European public, the war would have been over in like one-fifth of the time.
Mm-hmm.
The pictures and stuff that get back to us today, the alternate media is really the only ones that report on the truth. Show truthful pictures and
sure. Yeah, but, during the Vietnam. So I was living in America during the 60s, and so during the Vietnam War, you saw a lot of bodies and coming back, in flag, draped with flags and. Body count and lots of, horrible things. And,
oh, yes.
During the Gulf Wars, we didn't see too much of that. It was very, very controlled, the imagery.
It was. Saw. Yeah. Yes. I was 14 when the Vietnam War ended. I didn't really pay much attention to what they shown on the TV as far as what the war was coming back here, but I was a kid. It didn't really bother me. I didn't care. Mm-hmm. I knew the war was going on, but it didn't really bother me. But
yeah, well, I was 15 during that, and I think when I became 17 or 18, they wanted to draft me, and I just said I can't go over there and kill people that haven't done anything to me. I had a real problem with it, so I was really part of the. I was a kind of, you could say I was an anti-Vietnam War resistor, and everybody really got into it, and people were quite bold and quite challenging to the government until Kent State, when yes. the government, started killing us, and yes. that's when everybody dispersed, and we all went underground. Kind of most people said, well, I'm going to the country and start an organic farm or something, or, everybody kind of, went and, contemplated their navel and tried to understand what just happened, and tried to realize, began to realize that maybe, we weren't really ready to go to that extent, and that the government had won. Now, in the end, McNamara, I did a video, I can't remember what it was called.
It was late in his life, yeah. It was an interview.
The interview, and he said in the end we were right, and that it was all manipulation, and that the hippies were right in the end, so.
Well, actually, what he said was we went to war on a lie. More or less, he said the Gulf of Tonkin affair never happened. It was all manipulated.
Flag.
It was all manipulated attack. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So imagine that. So in order for business to turn over a profit, we've got to find some bodies. So in a sense, it's like, that's to be really honest with you. I'm going to be brutally honest now. That's one of the reasons I left America because I was a foreigner. I lived in America and I lived there for a number of years, taxpayer, but because I was, I would live in America, I live around the world, and I would, I went into many cultures and saw many things. It was the war machine that finally made me kind of go like, I don't know if I can contribute to this anymore. So I thought, well, maybe I can go live somewhere else where at least I won't be doing that. And then, of course, there are other problems in other countries.
It's all about honor and all about a conscience. If somebody has a conscience or not, just the fact that billions and billions of Americans' tax dollars are going to killing people that never did anything to any of us over here. And people have been brainwashed into believing that they actually did do something to us.
Yeah. And I mean, I imagine if you could take that money now and, and apply it to, let's say, like I know America's infrastructure. I know that so much of the money isn't getting to the states anymore, and everybody's inventing taxes. And I know you got highway patrol people, like you have a speed limit, and then you have a steep hill, and then at the bottom of the hill, it'll say like 25 miles per hour. And then there's always the highway patrol van waiting there to with the radar gun or whatever. I mean, it's crazy that, the level that people are getting to try to get tax revenue. So just kind of like what Clinton and Gore did is to kind of balance the budget and make that money available for other things. And I know that. that there's a lot of potential, and but it just changes. It just takes a change of attitude or a change of perspective to apply that to money in a different way. Maybe to, you know, rebuild America's infrastructure, because I know the bridges are crumbling and you know, all of the infrastructure is falling apart because the money isn't getting to where it needs to get, and because so much of it is being been invested or being invested in fighting all these wars, you know. So I think, you know, like, for example, you look at a country like Switzerland. In Switzerland, every single person in Switzerland has a gun.
Yes,
they all have a. Everyone has a gun in their closet. Not only do they have
They're obliged by the government to own a gun.
Yeah, and not only that, but not only would, let's say, the teenager who you know, who's, like, say, he's late teens or early 20s, is signed up, you know, has to go train, but his father's gun is there, which is an older gun, and his grandfather's gun is there, all with a bunch of magazines, you know, and they're all sitting in their cabinets, you know, and if anybody invades that country, every single person is fully armed and knows exactly where they need to go. So therefore, their military is highly tuned, you know, to, you know, and everybody, I mean, they got jets sitting in bunkers, you know, in mountains. All of a sudden the mountains opens up and all these jets fly out, you know, fully loaded with missiles. So, you know, they're not busy attacking people. They're busy enjoying their lives and living incredible abundance there. But everybody's ready. If you mess with them, man, they're armed to the teeth and they're ready to just fight back like there's, you know, like there's no tomorrow. So, I think that's a much better approach. You know, if America's concerned about being attacked, you know, maybe they need to quit, you know, destroying the economy and invest more money in America, create jobs, and make sure that everybody's ready. So if America gets attacked, you know, it's going to be hard to occupy because everybody's going to be ready to defend their lives and their land. So, I mean, I think that's a much better approach than the one that you have now, where I mean, I don't really want to criticize America, you fight a war based on what you think they might do, you know. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind criticizing America. It's not the nation it once used to be. It's been infiltrated by so many groups that it's just not the country it used to be.
Well, you know, it's not the people; it's the government.
Sure, it
it's
is.
The,
it, sure
which
it
is being manipulated. Just in the same way, like when the Cold War with the Russians was happening, they were the most evil power in the world. But then, when the wall came down and they gave up, they were our best friends. So then, what you realize, it wasn't the Russian people; it was simply the governments that were having this problem with each other.
Absolutely.
But they enrolled all the people into believing it. You know.
Well, yeah, That's what the stereotype does, Jan. But we've only got about 3 more minutes here till our break, and we're going to have about a 7.5-minute break. But I want to go ahead and give out the Skype numbers. I'm not sure if anybody would like to call in and discuss some things. We can go ahead and do that. I thought about it a little while ago, but then it slipped my mind. But I'm not sure what number somebody has to call. But the studio number is 347-688-2902, and my Skype number is 269-591-7828, or Stephen, Stephen, c.roberts1. I have a few people that have called in, and I have his contacts. Somebody would like to call in during the break, or before, or just after, they are more than welcome to, and I do want to say we are listener supported, so please go hit that donate button if you can. I know the goal has been met, but every little donation is appreciated. I think after the break, I want to get into the differences between the American sovereign movement or the Canadian freemen or the American freemen and the what the Irish and Scottish are doing over there. They are doing a lot of things differently than what the Americans are. But that'll be after the break here. I think I will go ahead and pop Jan's website in there just before the break. And do you have anything to take us out here this last minute and a half or anything until we come back?
Oh, no, no, you're doing a great job there.
Well, okay. I haven't, I deliberately don't try to speak a lot when I have somebody good on that has a lot of good information because, well, it's not always about me. It's about someone else's information.
Well, it's about people becoming more free, you know, because, you know, we're all always talking peace, man, or like, you know, we're free, you know, but what does freedom mean? What does it mean to be free?
Yes.
What is peace? You know, what is peace? What is well-being? What does it all mean? Other than, you know, for a lot of people, it's just a word, but what does it actually mean to be free, to be at peace? What does that mean?
Yes, it does. What does it mean? I ask a lot of my listeners on other networks, what does it mean to be free? And just how free are we here in America? And there's my music. We are at the break, okay. Everyone. So we'll be back in about 7.5 to 8 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, and welcome back, everyone. We are back from the break. This is still the Sunday afternoon Revolution Radio's Cancel the Cabal show. I'm Stephen Roberts, and I still have, let me get this up here, Jan van der Ven of Direct Democracy Ireland. I said it twice, and then it slipped my mind. But anyways, before the break there, Jan, we were going to ponder some of the differences of some of these movements all over the world. I know it is a worldwide movement, and everybody seems to have a different idea, but from some of the things that I've looked at, I think there are some of these American movements over here and some of the Canadian movements. They just seem to be doing some things wrong.
Well, to be honest with you, I can't tell you that much about the Freeman movements because I personally haven't looked into it myself. For me, you know, to be a freeman is to be free. And for me, freedom is a state of being. So I spent a lot of time, you know, I spent many years, you know, living in India. I've been to Tibet and I've walked the Himalayas and you know, shamans and jungles and learned all these methods to enable me to be free, free inside, free as a, you know, to have an experience of well-being. Where the mind stops and you feel, you know, you feel connected to life, connected to nature, and you're completely free and with a state of well-being. So for me, the Freeman movement has been to learn what freedom is and what true peace is. So that's what made me political. The fact that it was when I read the Declaration of Independence, when they said we have these unalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when you meditate, what you meditate on is your life force. And through that, you become free and you become happy. So it's actually finding freedom within that made me free and enabled me to question reality or authority. And now I'm working to start undoing the shackles, like the way that the systems work, the democracies work these days. Now, I mean, sure, I've had exposure to the Freeman movements and, you know, I understand the basic principles and I've looked into it a little bit, but I personally haven't decided to get rid of my social security number or my passport or, you know, driving my car without a license plate or, you know, all these things. I think the main thing that I have in common with the Freeman movement is that we have a deep appreciation for sovereignty and wanting to live more sovereign, you know, and what does that mean? Now, I know that for me to live more sovereign is to get the monkey off my back, is to get the government's hand out of my wallet, you know, to get them out of my bedroom so they can't tell us what to do and tell me what religion to follow or whatever. You know, so for me, it's been more something of that nature than the one where you know, you can blatantly, you know, confront the government and change the flag. I know that when I used to, in California, when I used to get pulled over, you know, and they'd want you to sign the ticket, you know, under penalty of perjury or, you know, that if you didn't sign the ticket, they would arrest you. you know, and I would always, you know, write, you know, under duress, you know, like UD, and I would sign it. So, because I know that in order to invalidate, you know, you can't sign a contract under duress. It makes it invalid. Or, you know, when I used to sign my tax returns, my 1040s, it would say under penalty of perjury, and I would take my ballpoint pen and I'd scratch out perjury, and I put a little, you know, a little initial in the column there saying, yeah, you want me to sign this contract, but I don't agree with the contract. So I would amend the contract. So I would do things like that, but I've never really blatantly, you know, stepped out and say, well, forget it. I'm not going to, you know, have a driver's license, or I'm not going to do that, because that would have complicated my ability to function. So I've decided to sort of try to change the machine from within the machine than to fully challenge the machine in a way.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I don't have any plans on tearing up my Social Security number either, or cutting up my driver's license. You know, it's a lot of these movements over here in America and Canada are doing that. They just seem to be bucking the system, and it's not really the way to go at it. There's a different way, and there is a better way, and I think the Irish and the Scottish are doing it a little more peacefully. They're not challenging the system so much. They're just not getting into the system.
Well, you know, it's interesting though, here in Ireland, which one of the things I thought was really amazing was, you know, I've been living here for about 10 years now, was that, and you know, I always call this the mother country in a way for America, you know, because America is such a connection to the Irish, you know, and so it's fascinating to be living here and to, you know, to experience it on that level. But, you know, what I love about the Irish here, you can sue the state on behalf of the Irish people. So if there's something you feel really strongly about, you can sue the government on behalf of the Irish people, and the government has to pay for your lawyer and has to pay for all of the court costs, you know, and I think that's a great thing, that the Irish people, they have the ability to actually do that. So there are people out, you know, that use that law, and they, like, for example, a friend of mine did it recently because we had a referendum. And he felt that the referendum was, you know, the state wanted to go one way, and the people, a lot of people wanted to go the other way. But because the state initiates the referendum, then they were able to outspend the other people. And so he felt that was unfair, and he sued the state on behalf of the Irish people and won in the Supreme Court. You know, so I think that's a cool thing, you know, and I think that's something that I think America could use too. If you could sue America, you know, sue the government on behalf of the, you know, without having to, you know, having to have, you know, all these expensive lawyers and millions of dollars to try to even challenge.
I'd certainly like to find out.
Do it, you know?
I'd certainly like to find out. But I was surprised to find out actually that there are, I think some between 70 and 75 million Irish Americans. That's like, almost 25 times the population of Ireland right now.
Mm-hmm. The diaspora. Yeah. Well, the problem with and it's wonderful. It's an amazing thing. And that, you know, and they have influenced so many cultures, you know, and even, you know, even American presidents, a lot of them can trace their roots back to Ireland. But like, for example, if you're an American living abroad and you want to vote, can vote in America. You can vote, and, you know, and, you know, you won't be disenfranchised, but the Irish people living abroad that don't live in Ireland cannot vote. And I disagree with that. I think if you're Irish and you live abroad and you have an Irish passport, you should be able to vote, but Ireland won't let you do that. So in a sense, that's, I think they're being disenfranchised.
Well, yeah, it sounds like they are. They have just as much right to, well, according to the ancestry, you know, if there was, some sort of royalty back then, an American here of Irish or Scottish or whatever, British ancestral background, they would have a right to claim the crown.
Well, yeah, if you have Irish, if you can prove that you had an Irish grandfather or a grandmother, or, you know, or a relative, and you're a descendant, you can get an Irish passport. If you get an Irish passport, it means that you could live in Europe, because Ireland's part of the European Union. I don't know if very many Americans know that. If you want to get out of America, just get yourself an Irish passport and you can come live over in Europe. and maybe you can find a better way. But that's open to so the diaspora, you know, if they would get valid Irish passports, which they can, but still, even with that, the Irish government won't let them vote, which I think is wrong. I think if you have, you know, if you have a citizenship of a country and you want to get involved in the politics, even if you don't live in the country, but if you have that citizenship, you should be able to vote.
Yeah, most certainly. Well, I know my ancestor, well, according to a cousin, I've either got Scottish or Irish, one or the other. I have to get in touch with him to find out. But one of my ancestors back in the middle of the 19th century immigrated from either Ireland or Scotland. But anyways, I want to give out the Skype numbers again if in case anybody would like to call in. The studio Skype is 347-688-2902. And my personal Skype is 269-591-7828 or stephen.c.roberts1, Stephen with S-T-E-P-H-E-N. So not that we don't have a lot of material or anything, but we would sure like to take some calls and talk about some things. We have plenty of things. I have plenty of things on my mind, and Jan does too. I think next subject I would like to talk about is the network that I'm involved with over in Ireland and Scotland. One of our favorite subjects over there is the Queen and the Crown. What is, what's it going to take to get people to realize that, somebody that is brainwashed and thinks they're special, they don't really have any power over us?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know about that because you see, like, my take on the whole thing is that that, you know, remember the royal families were running the roost there for a few hundred years, right? Several centuries, you know, from, and you know, they were imperialists and they stole a lot of the wealth. In fact, if you go walk around in some of these European cities and you see all the wealth, the money that built all of that, you know, was on the backs and the blood of a lot of the countries they invaded and the wealth that they took from these countries. So when we had our revolutions and we became democracies and we sort of toppled the kings and the queens, they'd always been working with banker families. And I think that a lot of their money is diversified and offshore. And I think that if you look deeper into it, you find out that their money is actually invested in a lot of the large multinationals, maybe through shell companies and things like that. And that they are actually controlling the world, you know, because how much influence the corporations have in the world. And I'm not poo-pooing corporations because I think, you know, corporations are good. But I think that when a corporation begins to influence government and tries to influence legislation to their advantage and to the adverse effect of the many to suit the few, I think I have a problem with that, you know, that it, you know, that it shouldn't be that way. And, that you find out that the royal families are still have a lot of influence, but they're doing it through their banks, through their oil companies and through their large multinationals. And if you look at the way a lot of them behave, you know, like, for example, oil companies have no problem, you know, going to some small country saying, hey, we want your oil and this is the deal we want. And the person running the country says, you know, I don't think so. You know, I care about the people and we want to, you know, make sure that, you know, it's all fair and on the up and up. And next thing you know, he has a revolution on his hand and somebody trying to topple him, you know, so, and 100,000 lives are lost. And then the guy gets into power who caters to what they want. So, you know, and if you look at the way a lot of these big multinationals are behaving, they remind me of exactly the way the sovereigns used to behave when they were ruling the world with a lot of tyranny, you know, and a lot of tyrannical ways and manners. So, when you talk about the crown, you know, I think about that. And of course, on the other hand, I mean, they're no better than we are. They're a human just like you and me, but they just benefit from fame and money. And that's why they can be where they are.
Well, they also benefit from brainwashed subjects, indoctrinated.
They watch
people.
A lot of TV.
Yeah, well, they parade around in these elaborate little suits and elaborate machines that carry them around, and they have people that cater to them, and most of the people all around the world think that they're special.
But I think there's a lot of that going on because, you see, as long as they can keep us, believing all that stuff and getting all, involved in the sex life of famous people and, who's doing it, what to who, and, all this talk and all this, energy and information that revolves around all these things, they got us so busy with that stuff. Meanwhile, while we're all, looking at that stuff, they're all over at the Treasury with their pickup trucks, just throwing the money out by the bushel and driving off into the sunset. So, they're looting the Treasury. So,
right.
So I think it's all very, very contrived. And as long as, if you grow up believing that that's real because they've told you that that's real, then they've accomplished their goal,
Certainly it has. They have a very elaborate magician that they put in a studio, and they put a camera on him, and he's got these quick flashy hands, and you're supposed to be watching his left hand while his right hand is doing something that is unseen, and the people in the audience are captivated.
Yeah. I remember several times when I was living in America. Over the years, I remember several times where there would be some banking disaster, and it would be like national television, and they were going, "Now for the banking story," and I'd go, "Oh yeah, the banking story," and they would go, "Shh," and now for our next story.
They would cut the stream. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I've seen it so many times when I was living. Have you ever seen that?
No, I sure haven't.
I've seen it.
I remember when we had only three and four stations, and you had to get up off of the couch or the chair or the floor to change the channel. But I'm sorry, Jan, but I didn't pay attention to the TV way back then. I was outside doing too many things, I guess.
Oh yeah, no. I've always had because I've lived all over the world. I've always been very interested in politics and what's going on, and always checking everything out and trying to understand everything. So I've had a kind of a media mind like that, and to the point where the people I work with are so sick of it that I finally became a politician. So they didn't want to listen to it anymore. So now I found a country where I could say this stuff, and you're listening to it too. So that's good for me.
Well, I think we can blame that on Barack Obama over here. A lot of us can anyways.
Well, Barack Obama, everybody, I knew a long time before he got elected what the story was with him. Because if you go back and you watch him, you watch his early campaign, it all changed when he had a meeting with Zbigniew Brzezinski. And the moment I realized that he had a 2-day meeting with Zbigniew Brzezinski in the, maybe 8 or 9 months before he was elected, I knew that the guy wasn't everything that he said he was going to be. I knew right there. And I told everybody that, and it turned out to be right,
Well, the way the story goes, Jan, he actually had a connection to Zbig, as he's called, Zbigniew, long before this 5 or 6 months, whatever you're talking about.
Eight months.
I guess the story goes that he's had a CIA background almost from day one. His grandparents and his mother was both in the company. His grandfather had some type of a furniture business that was a front for the CIA. Mm-hmm. And his grandmother was a banker for the CIA. She helped launder money. So from day one, there's been some kind of a plan with him.
Yeah. So it was when I saw that I immediately knew. See, I didn't know any of that other background. It was like the moment I saw that, I said, forget it. This guy is not.
Well, you saw what they wanted you to see.
Well, what I saw was the moment I knew, because, Zbig, he's a global strategist. When he sits in a, in the boardroom with the guys with big cigars, you know, they're looking at the resources of the world and they're figuring out how they can carve it up, and they're trying to create the playbook and how to, and in order to get their hands on those resources. So the moment I see, you know, a potential president meeting with those guys, you know, the guy who's behind the CFR and the trilateral, you know, I immediately knew, like, uh-oh, you know, this is not everything that we're that is cracked up to be, you know.
Yes, exactly. And the movie goes on. The people in the audience still keep continuing to watch the movie, or the
I don't know what they told him. You know, I don't know. You know, because I mean, I know that, you know, for example, I know a bunch of Africans, and I hear African stories. You know, and I know Europeans and East Europeans. I know people from all over the world because I'm constantly, you know, I'm living like where I work. We've got 80 different nationalities working there, but you know, they were telling me, like, in Africa, basically, you know, they just tell the African leaders that, look, you know, you want to be fabulously wealthy, you know, or do you want your children to grow up without a father? And so what do you think the guy's going to decide?
Yes, exactly. And I think sometimes some of the American politicians, I think some of them have really good intentions trying to get into an office, whether it's on the local level or mainly on the federal level is the worst. But I think they're brought into an office and sat down and told this is how something's going to be. And then they're showed this film that's of a president getting his head blown off. And, you know, they kind of pose that same question to people over here, I think. Mm-hmm. What do you want to be, fabulously rich or do you want your children to be orphans?
Yeah. And, you know, and you know that when the game is played on that level, when there's billions at stake, there are people who are willing to okay, here's $100,000, you know, take care of it for me. And the next thing you know, oh, the guy committed suicide in his car, or he jumped out of a window, or whatever, you know. So it works that way because the people who are benefiting from the gravy train are willing to go to that extent in order to, you know, to keep it going, you know. So anybody who challenges that, you know, so.
Yeah, you kind of alluded to something right there, Jan. I remember it because I seen it when I was a kid, but, you must remember the Godfather movie where Michael's talking to his wife and, start to bring up politicians having people killed, and she kind of naively says that politicians would never do anything like that, and Michael Corleone scoffs at her and tells her differently.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of gives her a little bit of a serious education on how the political world works.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do remember that, and I think a lot of people all around the world really don't believe that something like that, you know, like you happen to mention, when there's billions or even trillions are at stake.
Yeah.
They are going to do whatever it takes, whether it's 3,000 lives on September 11th or 2,700 lives on Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
December 7th, 1941. Mm-hmm. They're going to do whatever it takes to make that money.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and again, I mean, we don't really know what happened. I mean, we can project all that stuff, you know, but one thing that is obvious, that the outcome of all these things, you know, because you could have gone after these terrorists and treated them as criminals and arrested them and then brought them to court because they were criminals. But what we did is we declared war on terrorism because if you went after them as criminals, you can't just fire a missile into a building. You have to actually isolate the criminal and capture him and, you know, bring him to justice. But if you declare war on the criminal, then you can just fire a missile into the building and everybody who's dead is collateral damage. It's it's like saying, oh, I'm going to declare war on terrorists in the United States. And, you know, in the United States, what they do is they actually try to catch the terrorists and minimize the damage. But imagine, in another country where you know, like there's an office building and they go, oh, the terrorist is in that building, bomb it, and they bomb it to the ground. They don't care about all the lives that were lost. So it's just collateral damage. That's crazy.
Certainly it is. Yeah. like you happened to, well, I mean, it's like you alluded to just a minute ago. They declared war on an idea instead of an actual physical human or humans.
Yeah.
They declared war on terrorism and not a terrorist. I'm getting a call here. I'm going to take and see what's going on here.
All right, we've got a caller.
Hi, caller.
Yes. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are. Can you mute your radio, please? Or?
Yes, I already did it.
All right. Who do I have here?
My name is Dan. I'm from New Jersey.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
Oh, so far, so good. You know, keep a low profile and try to just see how I'm going to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I listen to you gentlemen, and you make so much sense, and I appreciate, you know, your patriotism, but I'm an old man, and you're a young man. I've been through a revolution, and I will ask you, with the power from the 30s and the 20s of Tesla, and the amount of people who are like yourself, like myself, refuse to accept, and I was taught as a child to always question authority. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it got me into a lot of trouble. But I still, to this day, you have to understand, they called us hippies. That was the government's name, because we were revolutionaries, but it was nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
And from Jump Street, I knew that it was never going to work. But I threw in with it because it was beautiful and it was a great, great time to be young.
Mm-hmm.
But, Big Brother, just like you said, shows the picture of Kennedy. Big Brother assassinated every one of our leaders, our great leaders. Probably the greatest was Kennedy, and the coup d'etat started there. And the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Edgar Evans.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's a great
John Lennon.
Malcolm X.
I'll go with Lennon. That's why he's dead.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what? I don't know if you know this, but this really happened. When he was shot, they called an ambulance, of course. The police were called. But there, listen to this, just happened to be an off-duty police officer, was some kind of a officer, federal or what, in his own private car, happened to be passing, and put Lennon, it was a two-door car, two-door, and put Lennon in the back seat and took him to the hospital. Now, how many people do you think even know that?
Absolutely. Caller, did you also know that the morning Lennon got shot, George Herbert Walker Bush was having breakfast with his father?
With Lennon's father?
Hinckley Jr.'s father.
Hinckley Jr.'s father, yes. My mistake.
That is an automatic Sirhan. I mean, like, you know, they did it then. They got away with that. Robert Kennedy, Sirhan was 18 feet away from Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy, rest in peace, had powder burns in his hair.
Yes, he did. He never. Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is,
he was in front of him the whole time, too.
Excuse me?
I said Sirhan was in front of Kennedy the whole time, too.
It reminds me of the Manchurian candidate idea.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand that. But what I'm trying to say is, the power that they possess, the Manchurian candidate, that was bought, the rights to that was all bought by Sinatra not to be released after his death, then he came out. But what I'm trying to say is, with the power that they possess, do you really think we got a chance?
Well, it's all in who we vote for. voting them in.
The machines are fixed. Yeah, so what is voting? Is a joke. It's a computer. Now, you tell me. I'm not computer smart. You young men are. Can I be played with?
What
happened to the old machines when you pull the hand? You weren't around then. you pull the handle.
We still have them machines, caller. In my little district, we still have them machines.
Guess what? I just ran for an election here in Ireland, and they actually brought, you know, because the election had the one that I ran in, 600,000 people voted, and they brought all those votes into a room and counted them. And it was really, you know, and I was there for the count. So it was quite thrilling to experience the whole thing. And it's very interesting.
I agree with that. Okay, you think that'll ever happen here? And I am an IRA supporter. And I also informed Che Guevara's grandfather was Irish.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And okay. So, I mean, like, but do you really think that we have the slightest chance
I think what you have is the chance to change the narrative. What you need to do is for example, we've been campaigning for direct democracy. What that means is you take the power. See, here in Ireland, the government can initiate a referendum. So what you do is you take the power to initiate away from the government and you give it to the people. So the government can never do that. And we've been campaigning for this. You know, I've been talking about it for 10 years, and finally we created a political party. And on the national media, 6 o'clock news, we had a press conference and they covered it. And they said, Direct Democracy Ireland believes that the citizens should have the power to overrule the government on laws that they don't accept. So what that meant was on May 7th, on the 6 o'clock news, our message entered into the media narrative. Once it entered into the media narrative, all of a sudden, the next whole bunch of interviews I had journalists coming up to me, sticking microphones in my face, tell us about citizen-initiated referendum, tell us about direct democracy. So what's happened is that the debate around this issue has finally entered into the mainstream media. That's what you have to do in America. You have to get the debate into the media, into the mainstream, so that it becomes totally the thing to do and totally hip. And once you do that and you've captured the mind space, or then possibly you have the chance for change. If you can never bring it to that point, you might not ever get it.
Don't you think that you have a controlled media over there?
Oh, of course we do. Of course we have a controlled media. I remember.
Listen to Radio Free Erin?
No, I haven't. But I've seen how they try to even control us. You know, they get our names wrong. They get the party's name wrong. They do all kinds of little dirty tricks. I even saw it in America. When I lived in America, Jerry Brown ran for president, and I was part of his team. And I saw how on the 6 o'clock news, you know, like, let's say we had a big, you know, Jerry Brown would have a big rally, and it'd be 10,000 people cheering with flags going, Jerry, Jerry, Jerry. And then Clinton would have the same thing. But what do you think they showed on the 6 o'clock news? They showed Bill Clinton with a big, you know, everybody, Bill Clinton, flags everywhere. And Jerry, they would show him like walking down the street and it'd be a drunk laying in an alleyway, shaking a person's hand. So what perception did they create there?
Of course. He's a loser.
He's
talking to power. I'm asking you, I mean, like, don't get me wrong. God bless every one of you.
But Dan, I got a question for you, Dan. How many people? Well, you said you're older, and you've always been questioned. You always question government. Yeah.
How old are you?
72.
I'm 61.
God bless you, Dan. Good for you.
Anyways, thank you. God bless you too.
Yeah.
But like that 10 years was a big difference. You see, in that 10 years, 61 to 72, and that big difference, like, you know, like all our great leaders, all our great ones, even ones that were, like, you know, contemplating going to the presidency, Larry McDonald from the southern states. I mean, if you even were an actual Jeffersonian type person, you were dead. He got on the airplane, and I'm like, you know, nobody knows, nobody cared. And like, they're killing people left and right. Emmett Till's mother, does that ring a bell with you? Princess Diana and Carl with Fahid.
Yes.
Does that ring a bell with you with the Ireland? Now, me hearing you say that you never heard of Radio Free Erin, that, like, you know, maybe this phone call is in vain. But, I will give it to you. It's on, if I can mention the station that it's on in Manhattan.
No, I'll take a look.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll look into it.
Okay, please. It's on Saturday. It's either from New York Times. Saturday, from 12 to 1 or 1 to 2, Radio Free Erin, 99.5 FM. And, like, you know, these young men are here in America. And Irish saw to the eyes, Polish saw to the eyes, Italian saw to the eyes. You know, they came here, and German saw to the eyes. They all came here and made a contribution. You know, they all came here and made America. I seen America. America was the most beautiful place in the world. I seen the education that I got. My kids can't figure out 20% tips and they're college graduates.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Gotta take out a card. God bless them.
Yeah.
I mean, but like, you know, I mean, like, when I talked in a classroom, I got my head beat in.
Yeah.
So I didn't do that because I was disrupting her class.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, they got people like me, like, you know, how to bring your mother to school. You got to have them beaten when you went home. Then they went after the mother because they figured she was the backbone of the nation. They took her out of the house. Gloria Steinem, somebody asked her in Manhattan, downtown, in the village area, that she was like, women's rights, burn your bra, you know, degrading the women, like, get out of the house, be something.
Damn.
They said to her, Miss Steinem, let me ask you a question. Were you ever a CIA, are you a CIA agent? Answer, no, but I used to be.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And now they went after the police. Because if you were doing something evil, I mean, like evil, like you raped a little girl, yeah, he fell off the roof. Well, he ain't gonna rape my little girl.
Yeah.
Why is it? Yeah, he thought he went to jump from one roof to the other. We were chasing him. But he didn't make the other roof. He just, you know, now they went after the police. You can't, in other words, if the cop is not being sued, he's not doing his job. I understand there's bad apples in every barrel, but the majority of policemen, have my support. I understand enforcing the laws. I'm a sovereign legally. So I understand that if a police officer pulls me over and he says to me, you get a license, registration, insurance card, and I say, I don't need it. I have a bond here. You know, I don't need your license. What happens? He doesn't know because he's not educated. Just like the children aren't educated in school. He says, what's going to happen? My card is going to get towed and I'm going to have handcuffs on. But I'm sovereign legally in the state of New York.
Yes, I know. But like you just mentioned, Dan, the uneducated don't care about what the truth is.
Well, the cold, yes. So it's over. And whose fault is it? I'll tell you exactly. And I'll put myself at the top of the list.
It's everyone's fault, yes.
Generation's fault. We almost had them.
Dan, you know that there are literally 2.5 million to 3 million of these types of shows out there. Things, people are...
Well, that scares me too. Because, like, when we try to put up our own pueblos, when we try to put up our own printing presses, they were busted up. The feds came in and busted them up and busted us up. Move to Canada. To put the printing presses in Canada to distribute the pamphlets on the street. Came to Canada. I mean, listen, nonviolence. That's just, like Malcolm X. What'd he do? One of my heroes. He said to the black man, stay home. Stop using drugs. He said, take care. You made a baby fetus. I don't want this type of being a Muslim. I don't believe,
and he put a bullet in his head.
That's where he came from. He used to play in a Calypso band.
Yes, he did. But there is a movement out there, Dan.
Gentlemen, listen, I have a call, I have to go, but I just want to say, I think I'm with you. I mean, like, I always think there's somebody out there at least doing it, but I fear that it's lost. I hope I'm wrong. And I hope, but the technology that they possess, with even the sound waves, I've experienced myself. I experienced their delusion. I am a legitimate MK Ultra subject at the age of 14. The provenance that I can provide, I have already cleared security, and I put this away because I got set back for 18 months. But I put this away. I was already cleared for security to go to Fordham University, because that's where they did it to me, in the Bronx, when I was 14 years old. And it's a long story that is not to be told on the air, because it's real, real, real. And I never knew it until I got older, and I started with MKUltra and started putting the pieces together. I filed a complete paperwork on them. I could sue them. I want my money. I filed the money. I filed it. I sent it in. They have me. I am considered an extreme right-wing economic terrorist. All because I became sovereign, which gave me a bond of 500 beers and boy billion dollars to discharge debt. Try to do it. Everybody laughs at you. They hang up on you. I had them even ask me if I was a talk show host. Yeah, was I a talk show host? Oh, you named the bank around the world. I called it. You know, I found my paperwork. Now the green card. As green card comes back, the green card was stamped to the Treasury on the birth certificate. At 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, my green card. The return green card, same one, came back stamped Ogden, Utah. Okay, we know that. We know all about Ogden, Utah. But I called the Treasury direct. I'm a cripple, although I thought I'd walk in. I called them direct. And here's what the woman said. She put the phone to the side and talked to a fellow worker and said, I got one of the birth certificate nuts on the phone. I said, excuse me, ma'am, what did you say? She said, no, I didn't say anything. And I'll direct you to your call. Gentlemen, but listen, God bless you. Keep up the fight. And, like, you know.
Take care, Dan. Take care of yourself.
Dan.
I'll be with you.
Dan, sure. I just wanted to say to you, people are ripe. This is only happened. Yeah, oh well, he's gone. But I can tell you in the audience, so this has happened before. I believe it was the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s. This movement got very, very close. No, I'm sorry, not the 80s. 90s. Late 80s, early 90s. This movement got very, very big and very, very close to a peaceful revolution. And then there was two things that happened. First was the Waco siege down there in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that movement, a lot of them people got demonized and then they got, obliterated. And mm-hmm. then 2 years later, the Murrah building, the federal building in Oklahoma City got bombed. And it, pretty much squashed the movement. And it's taken this long to build it back up.
I can tell you something about that Oklahoma bombing.
Yeah.
I was living in LA at the time, and my partner was a clinical psychologist, and she decided to volunteer her services to help counsel the people that were traumatized by that, right? So she flew over there, and with my daughter, who was about 7 or 8 years old at the time, and my daughter acted as the receptionist, and they were there for a week helping people deal with the trauma. And when my daughter came back to LA, where I was living at the time, the entire school came out and honored her for what she'd done.
Okay. Yeah, that must have been a good experience for her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I was pretty proud about that, you know, that she that she had that experience.
Yeah. And I've got a... I don't know. It's a not really a funny little story, but It's a little story. I knew nothing about any of this patriotic movement back then. I was totally asleep. I would watch the indoctrination television nightly. You know, I went along with the.
You're being programmed.
Yes.
The program.
Yes, I was. I was going along with the Republican flavored Kool-Aid.
And what is that, the blue or the red pill?
That's the red pill.
Okay.
Or the red Kool-Aid, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I used to have some ham radio equipment. I had a little ham radio set up in my room, and I was listening to a bunch of people talk, and there was an older gentleman like 8 or 10 miles away from me in a neighboring town. And he was talking one night. It was about a year and a quarter. It's about, I don't know, 13, 14, 15 months after the Waco siege.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked for quite a long time, months and months and months, 3, 4, 5 months. And he was always drunk when he would talk. But he would always say stuff like, they're going to get theirs. The feds are going to get theirs. We're going to get them back. It's coming soon. He was always drunk every single night, and he was an older gentleman in his 70s. But he always repeated the same thing, and everybody would always laugh at him and cuss him out and run him off the air. But he knew something. He was part of the movement back then before the federal building got blew up. And it just never occurred to me that even an older man could have been speaking the truth.
Yeah,
but I guess, well, we only got about 4 or 5 minutes here, Jan, so I don't want to waste a whole lot of time on, you know, the past. We need to look to the future.
Yeah, well, like, what do you think about that comment I made about the narrative, that it needs to get into the narrative?
Sure.
Because you know, like, as I, you know, I told you the Jerry Brown story and all of that, and for example, I was just campaigning for a month here to try to win a seat in the European Parliament. Well, I didn't succeed, but I tried. And what I discovered was, you know, and this is probably well known, is that the newspapers don't have the resources to fund people to really do investigative reporting. So what they rely on is press releases. So all the spin doctors, everybody's constantly feeding them press releases. So the news that you're seeing is extremely spun because if you send a newspaper a press release and they want to do your story, they'll misprint it word for word. They cut and paste the whole thing, and you supply them with photographs and you supply them with the story. So the whole thing, you know, everybody's sitting there reading the newspapers and they're all thinking like, oh, look, we're so smart. The whole thing is completely being spun, being manipulated by people who are trying to, you know, manufacture consent. Maybe we should say it that way. So, so it's really, 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 really clear and really obvious to me that a lot of that is what's going on. And you can see even on YouTube, you see the same story, you know, being told, and everybody's like given the news, and there are news stations all over North America and Canada. And it's all the same story that's being spun out there, you know, but being delivered by the unique anchor. But it's the same story. So there's a lot of manufacturing consent going on, and all the brains are like stuck in that program. They're all getting the same information, and they sit around and they talk and they go, oh yeah, look at this. You know, did you know about this? You know about that? But it's all information that's being fed. And I realized a long time ago, I think I was 15. I remember saying it to my dad. I said, you know, when you look at a communist country and you look at a Western country, like we have a lot of freedoms. And I think what's going to happen, you're going to always throw the communist country, you know, you throw them another right, and everybody's, yay, look, we got another freedom, another right. But in our countries, you know, they're always going to be taking away another right and another freedom, unless we at some point say, no, that's it. You know, see, we need to understand what sovereignty is. If you really understand what sovereignty is and really understand and know what it is to be truly free inside yourself, and you know what well-being is, truly what it is, you've realized that it's a state of being, it's an experience within that nobody can take away from you, then you can turn and look at the laws, and you look at the laws of the land, and you say, no, this is totally against freedom, this is totally against sovereignty, this is totally against being. This is making me unhappy. You know, if we have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, this is actually taking away my happiness and taking away my liberty, and we shouldn't stand for it. But people have to really appreciate what that is.
It is. Can you maybe boil down in about 30 seconds? I have Jan van der Ven of Direct Democracy Ireland. Can you boil down in 30 seconds what Americans can do to help Irish people?
To help the Irish people. Ireland. What they can do is they can support Direct Democracy Ireland, and they can get involved with helping us, you know, and helping us to promote the politics, you know, here, because I know that if we can change Ireland, Ireland's a very small country, and by changing Ireland, we can actually change the European Union. So that's why it's so important that we are successful here in Ireland with this message.
Yes, we can. And that's my music, Jan. I appreciate you coming on. So I will see everyone next week. I have a new guest for next Sunday. Thank you, everyone.